Hey, Berry besties. Welcome back to Life in the Berry Lane. Today, we're launching into part one of my conversation with Dr. Evan Nadler. Talking with Dr. Nadler was so incredibly eye-opening. This conversation is one of the most important that I've ever had. He's a leading pediatric bariatric surgeon. He is a pioneer in his field, and what he shared completely changed how I understand obesity, not just as a condition, but as a disease that starts long before we ever step on a scale. He also helped me to understand my own story. So in this first part, we're talking about childhood obesity, what makes it different, why kids can't simply eat themselves into type 2 diabetes, and how the body defends a weight set point in ways most of us never knew possible. If you've ever looked back at your own story and thought, why me? I did everything right. This episode will give you some answers and maybe a little peace. Let's ride. Welcome, Dr. Nadler. I'm so happy to have you here today. I'm excited to have this discussion with you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So you work with pediatric bariatric patients, and this is fairly new to me because I didn't realize that pediatric patients younger than teenagers get bariatric surgery. What is the youngest that you have had to use surgery to intervene in obesity?
Yeah. So obviously it's not that common. And kids under 13, collectively, we sort of call it preteens. And I certainly have performed more surgery on kids under the age of 13 than anyone else in the country. And it's always for the same sort of medical problems that anyone who's dealing with obesity might suffer from. And, you know, I got started doing it just because it didn't make sense to me for any artificial number age cutoff to decide who gets treatment for a particular disease. So if you have obesity and type 2 diabetes at 11, why do you have to wait until you're 13 or 18 or an adult to get the intervention that we know has the best long-term success rate when it comes to treating both obesity and type 2 diabetes, which is bariatric surgery? So I started doing that actually almost now. I guess my first preteen was probably, I don't even know, I would say 10 years ago, if not more. You know, it works. It's obviously, so when people look at treating obesity, they sort of forget that obesity comes in a lot of different shapes and sizes and affects people differently. But hopefully it's understandable to people that if you have obesity and diabetes at age 10, not only do you need treatment, but treatment's going to be harder than if you have diabetes and obesity at age 40, because whatever's driving you to have that degree of the disease at such a young age is still there, because the surgery doesn't change that. The surgery just helps, you know, helps in the management of the problem. It doesn't change the underlying biology. So it's why childhood obesity in general is really a different disease. And I actually just heard from a colleague of mine today, she was at the American Academy of Pediatrics meeting over the weekend in Denver, and she went to a diabetes talk, and she was surprised, as I am, to hear that the diabetes medicines in children don't work as well as the diabetes medicines do in adults. And the speaker at this particular American Academy of Pediatrics meeting was actually pushing bariatric surgery for the treatment of children with obesity and type 2 diabetes, which frankly is kind of a, well, I find it appropriate and medically wise of that person, but I'm a little bit surprised just because pediatricians aren't really usually the ones who are advocating for surgery as an intervention. So it's kind of a, there was a change in their philosophy a couple of years ago when they published some guidelines, but this would be another sort of frame shift if they're actually, you know, out there giving lectures where they're advocating for surgery in children, bariatric surgery in children.
That's very interesting. I know in our previous discussion, you mentioned that a child can't eat themselves into type 2 diabetes. Why is that?
Yeah. Well, I kind of feel like no one really can, but especially in children, it's harder for, it's easy for society to blame patients when patients are whatever, 30, 40, grown adults making their own decisions. It's harder for society to blame children, although they end up blaming their parents instead. But still, it doesn't really make sense because, you know, the movie Super Size Me or the documentary or whatever that was. Yes, if you eat McDonald's three times a day, every day, you can make yourself sick. But no one eats that way. And the kids who I would see in clinic certainly weren't eating any differently or behaving any differently than their peers. You know, it's not like their family was opening sugar packets and pouring it down their children's throats while the other families were, you know, eating fruits and vegetables from the farm stand. You know, basically most of the kids in my practice were eating the same, behaving the same as any other kid. And if you think about it, again, if you have diabetes at age 8 or 9, just imagine how your eating habits would have to be to try to drive you to diabetes at that age. It can't be the food. I know there's this whole food is medicine movement in that's out there, but that they oversimplify the problems that they say they are treating with food. And certainly childhood obesity is not a disease that is going to be cured by food policy or dietary changes. Like, those data have been around forever that diet alone doesn't help. People lose significant weight and then kids, again, it's just not physically possible to eat poorly enough to give yourself diabetes at age 8 or 9. It doesn't even make intuitive sense.
Sure. So what makes childhood obesity different from adult onset obesity?
Yeah. So I'm writing a book on obesity and on childhood obesity. And I was discussing it with my editor and my agent yesterday. And I told them that I sometimes jokingly describe obesity as weight gain spectrum disorder, because it truly, gaining weight or excess weight affects different people differently, even if they look the same on the outside. And so childhood obesity, if I were describing it in the spectrum of the disease, is not only what I would consider a purer form of the disease, because again, less time on earth for these outside influences to impact the child, but it's also a more aggressive form of disease, which I sort of alluded to by saying, right, where I talked about the type 2 diabetes in kids is harder to treat than type 2 diabetes in adults. But it's also kids who have insulin resistance from their weight progress to type 2 diabetes more quickly than adults do. There are other diseases of childhood, like metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic liver disease is also more aggressive in kids and progresses more quickly in kids than it does in adults. So, and again, to me, it makes intuitive sense. And I hope to listeners, it makes intuitive sense that those who suffer from obesity as kids already have a stronger genetic or epigenetic drive to put on weight than those who develop obesity as adults. So in my mind, it's more important to treat kids with obesity earlier. And then it really stresses sort of the lifetime need for continued care, chronic care, you know, because as most people with weight issues or who treat weight issues know, there are lots of peaks and valleys along the way, and you just want to try to make sure that the peaks don't get too high. And obviously the valleys, you know, you want to keep them more as plateaus than as valleys. So it's, it you know, whether it's a different disease altogether or just, again, part of a spectrum, I just think childhood obesity is misunderstood. And actually, another piece of data that came across my way the other day was that 80% of children with obesity at age 2 will have it as adults, and 96% of adolescents with obesity will have it as adults if left untreated. So again, it just sort of underscores the chronic nature of the disease and the unrelenting nature of the disease, and the fact that kids do not grow out of their weight issues. That's probably one of those myths that's been most perpetuated along over the years and is the most inaccurate of all the things that we say. I mean, you just, your kid with weight issues is not going to grow out of them. They need help.
So you mentioned epigenetics and genetics. I think genetics is pretty common word, and people understand that. What is epigenetics?
Yeah, that's it's a good question, because epigenetics is, even scientists don't even really fully understand the role of epigenetics and exactly how it works. But in general, epigenetics are changes to your DNA, modifications to your DNA that don't change the sequence of your DNA. So the, for those who are into it, the A's, the G's, the C's, and the T's don't change. Those are still the same. But how your genes get expressed are changed by, well, one of the ways is something called methylation. And then there are microRNAs that can affect the DNA structure. And those changes change how the genes are what we call expressed, so what proteins get made and how they function. And then those changes are also heritable, meaning if you have those changes as a young man or woman and you are having babies, those changes get passed on to your offspring. And there's some data that specifically have suggested that actually the genetic changes in sperm or the epigenetic changes in sperm are particularly important. And then the other piece of the puzzle is the sort of in utero environment of the mom and the epigenetics of the mom that get passed on. So it's a complicated complicated paradigm, and epigenetics is a complicated field. But the more we learn about it, the more we are starting to understand why the epidemic of obesity continues along. And frankly, again, why diet and exercise aren't really going to change much in terms of the trajectory of obesity rates in America.
So to the point of, you know, the epigenetics and genetics and such, when you have done the bariatric surgeries on children, you studied the fat cells in their abdomen. Is that correct?
Yeah. So the fat cells from both the fat that is inside the abdomen, the visceral fat, which some of your listeners may know about, and the subcutaneous fat, which is the fat underneath your skin. And we compared the two. And, you know, we've long sort of known or understood that it's the fat inside your belly, inside your abdomen, that is the most metabolically active and the organ that is causing more health issues than the fat underneath your skin. But we actually studied both, and interestingly, among our findings was that the fat underneath your skin becomes more like the fat in your belly as you get more and more weight issues. You know, the higher your BMI, the more severe your obesity, the more your fat underneath your skin starts to look like the fat inside your belly. From a gene expression standpoint, which again just sort of speaks to the chronic nature of the disease. And actually, as I was just saying that, you reminded me of something important about epigenetics. So I want to go back to that question for a minute. So there's some recent studies have shown that your fat cells may have memory, meaning your remaining fat cells have been epigenetically changed by your obesity or by whatever, so that even when you lose weight via whatever intervention, lifestyle, medication, bariatric surgery, that some of the cells in your body sort of quote unquote remember their dysfunction and want to continue to function poorly, even at a lower weight. And they may actually drive you to gain weight. So that's another place where epigenetics may be really important in our understanding of the chronicity or the chronic nature of obesity.
Could that be related also back to trauma?
Well, so first of all, I hope I'm not being too boring for your listeners. I'm being very like technical and scientific in my discussion here. And I think, you know, I take care of kids, so usually I'm actually much more sort of jokey and try to relay this information in a less dry manner than I am doing right now. So I apologize for that. Maybe I should go get a coffee or something. But the trauma. So trauma is another one of those environmental influences, like the diet, or something I read posted today by one of the obesity advocates that's out there that was talking about, that included talking about pollution, because there's, you know, like the environmental, the forever chemicals and the plastics that are out there. So all of these things, and trauma and your diet, can all impact your epigenetics. So it can all modify the way your genes are expressed and can all predispose you to obesity or weight issues. Like, for instance, we know that adverse childhood events, including trauma as a child, can definitely increase your risk of developing obesity, either as a child or as an adult. So, again, I think the whole, and I hate to keep bashing this group, but it's also kind of our health secretary who sort of talks about the same thing, so I feel more comfortable bashing him. You know, this whole idea that all you have to do is eat better and your health will improve is so simplistic, and it might be true for a certain number of people, and it might be true for everybody in a small degree. Like your health might be minimally improved if you eat better. But this whole idea that America's health is going to be dramatically changed by, you know, even if we could snap our fingers and put our food sources back to the way that they were in the 50s or 60s, it's going to take decades, if not generations, for that type of intervention to have a real impact. So it just sort of bugs me when they get so much airtime. And the HHS secretary is making food policy, and our president is saying, look how great I am, I changed Coke from high fructose corn syrup to real cane sugar. Which, by the way, I do agree that Coke with real cane sugar tastes better than the high fructose corn syrup sugar Coke. I'm with him on that. But then to go tell everybody that this is going to be some great achievement that's going to make America's health better, it's all part of what I like to call the gaslighting of America on health, where we talk about these things as if they're going to make some great impact, and the science is just unequivocal that they won't. And it's like, it's this whole misinformation, social media influencer versus real science. So I'm honestly trying to be both. So I've decided that the only way to, if you can't beat them, join them. So if I can't beat the social media influencers, the only option is to become a social media influencer, but hopefully one backed by science so that we can start to, you know, change the conversation a little bit, or maybe at least ground the conversation a little bit. So obviously that's why I'm here doing these kinds of things, and have given up my full-time surgical practice to try to impact more people in a different way.
So I want to circle back to when you study fat cells and the microRNA level. What did you learn about our bodies and how they fight to stay at a certain weight?
Yeah. So those are two slightly different questions, but the fighting to stay at a certain weight is A, that whole fat cell memory thing I was talking about before with epigenetics is one way. But then the hypothalamus in the brain is really thought to be the major player in the defending your weight paradigm, and how the gut talks to the brain through the vagus nerve and other ways is still not fully understood. But what we really learned about those fat cells is that, so all cells in your body shed what are called exosomes, which are little transport molecules that in them have microRNAs. And that's one way the cells talk to each other around the body. And in this case, it's how the fat cells talk to the muscle or the liver or other organs that are involved. And what we found was that people at a normal weight, or people who are metabolically healthy, have one set of microRNAs in their fat cells, or at least a set ratio of the different microRNAs in their fat cells. And then as people would get metabolically unhealthy, that ratio would change, and we would see increased expression of certain microRNAs and decreased expression of others. And we actually had what we called a gene signature that we could find in people's fat cells when their metabolic health was least good. You know, the ratio of the microRNAs in the fat cells would change, and we could actually, you know, sort of predict how metabolically unwell you were based on the microRNAs in your fat cells. And they did come back to a more normal ratio with bariatric surgery. So, you know, we learned a lot about how, and it, unfortunately, a lot of that research has sort of stopped. And there are some people who are still looking at similar things, but it was really looking at the sort of what I would call the root of all the issues, which are when, you know, when your fat cells are basically storage cells. And when they exceed their storage capacity, they misbehave. And one of the ways they misbehave is leaking fatty acids out into your blood. They become inflammatory and leak all these cytokines and other things, inflammatory hormones out into your blood. But another one, which fewer people know about, are these exosomes and the microRNAs in these exosomes. So I'm hoping someday someone will pick up that sort of line of thinking again and get more in-depth knowledge of those cells. But until then, we're stuck with what we got.
So we talked about the hypothalamic weight set point in our previous conversation. And can you explain that in everyday language and then why it makes us feel like we might be feeling like we hit a wall at a certain point during weight loss.
Yeah. So one of the things we've learned over the years of bariatric surgery, which is one of the ones I find, frankly, the most fascinating, is that no matter what your sort of starting BMI is, and actually, you know, no matter how you get your surgery or who does your surgery, most patients have a change in their BMI of about 15 BMI units if they get a gastric bypass, and about 12 to 13 if they get a sleeve gastrectomy. And that's been about the same for 30 years, or, well, 30 years for the bypass. Sleeve's been around for closer to 20, let's say. So I find that really interesting, because why should it be so consistent? Like, why should it be that way? And the answer, we think, lies within the hypothalamic set point, and which is probably mostly determined in utero before birth. But then it's another way we think that epigenetics can change you, in that they can change your hypothalamic set point to a higher and higher weight over time if exposed to childhood trauma or forever chemicals or whatever. And so what we do know from patients with bariatric surgery is that as they lose weight, their metabolism generally slows down and makes the weight loss harder. And that's also true with weight loss from calorie restriction and medications as well. And so the body at some point just says enough is enough, and we're not going to let you get lower than what we want you to be at. We meaning the hypothalamus and its friends. And so that's sort of how the body does its thing. And there were some elegant studies back in the early 2000s that actually showed it to be true in the opposite direction as well. And going back to supersize me, same thing. Like, if you purposefully force yourself to gain weight, when you stop that intervention, your body almost immediately tells you to go back down to where it wanted you to be. So it's the body. The body is always smarter than the doctors and other people who are trying to mess with it. Like, it always outsmarts us. It always comes up with ways to, you know, to do what it's programmed to do, despite our best efforts to change that. I actually, when I first started doing bariatric surgery in kids, I saw some teenagers whose BMIs were in the, let's say, 70s and 80s, like really high. And I thought, well, I'm going to beat the average sleeve gastrectomy BMI change of 12, because I'm going to admit these patients to an inpatient weight loss facility first and have them lose some weight there. And then I'm going to do surgery. So I'm going to get my 12 after whatever they got from lifestyle in the inpatient facility. Turns out I was wrong. Turns out the body still had its number of 12 or 15 or whatever. So whatever they lost as a inpatient, let's say they lost 6 of those 12, I only got the other 6 after surgery. So it was another illustration of the body being smarter than the surgeon and medical provider. I didn't regret doing the surgery, because it's still a weight maintenance operation for those kids, because they're not going to likely be able to keep off all that weight without my help. But it wasn't the drastic, it wasn't the drastic success that I was hoping it would be. But that's not to say that, I mean, obviously I've also taken care of kids. I think the patient with the most weight loss that I've ever taken care of, I think lost like 400 pounds. So it can be done. It's not the average, you know, that there are always outliers that either outperform or underperform what you expect. But for the average person, that delta of 12 to 15 BMI units from bariatric surgery is like really hard to beat.
Since you do bariatric surgery on young children, a lot of people seem like they might be upset by that or angry. What would you say to those people?
Yeah. Actually, today I saw something posted on LinkedIn. One of my posts, a reporter done some interviews with me because she's writing an article, and because it's Childhood Obesity Awareness Month in September, she's been posting our interviews as sort of like a little vignettes. And, you know, some clown, for lack of a better word, bozo, I don't know, I don't want to be too inflammatory, but the guy just posts on my, as a response to her post, you know, and uses words that I don't normally use. So he truly posted something like, fat children tend not to have diabetes, they tend just to be fat, or something that's so like based in non, like he hasn't, there's no basis to say that. It's totally scientifically untrue, first of all. Second of all, the way he said it was just, he's basically just saying, you know, kids should just get up and move or whatever, same old baloney that other people say. So the point is that there are people who, no matter how hard you try to educate them, refuse to learn and refuse to understand and refuse to open their minds to the reality of the disease. But what I would say to those who, and I've had in the early days, I have had truly medical professionals call me a monster for offering surgery to children. Those people are probably, you know, hopefully a little bit more educated and hopefully realize I was just ahead of the rest of the country at the time. But I would just tell them to spend a day in my clinic, just spend one day in my clinic and talk to these kids and families and see how desperate they are. See that they don't, you know, eat McDonald's six times a day, that they don't, you know, sit on their cell phones any more than the average kid sits on their cell phones. And it will open your eyes. It will like change your perception of what's going on, which is frankly why I'm writing my book, is to try to sort of share what I've learned over 20 years taking care of children with obesity with the rest of the world, so that they can sort of stop shaming and blaming and just being, you know, just being miserable people when it comes to having empathy for their fellow humans who are suffering from a really, really difficult disease.
Yeah. And I think the lack of compassion and empathy toward people when you truly don't understand. I know our brains try to make sense of the world around us, given our experiences that, you know, we've had ourselves. But just because we don't understand something completely doesn't mean that we can just pass a judgment on whatever the situation is or how a person lives. That's part one of my conversation with Dr. Evan Nadler. I don't know about you, but I'm still sitting with a lot of what he said. For the first time, so much of my own story finally makes sense. The frustration, the shame, the years of, why can't I just, you fill in the blank. It's not weakness, it's biology. In part two, we go even deeper. We talk about the so-called easy way out, how surgery and medication actually work together, and why willpower isn't the magic fix we've been sold. It's honest, it's challenging, and it's going to blow up a few more myths. Take a deep breath, maybe a sip of water, and meet me back here for part two. I'll see you then. Hey, besties. Quick disclaimer as we wrap up. I'm not a doctor, dietitian, therapist, or any kind of medical professional. I'm just sharing my personal bariatric journey and the experiences, opinions, and stories that come with it. This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only. Nothing you hear on Life in the Berry Lane should ever be taken as medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment, even when my guests are professionals. Your body, your health, and your journey are unique. So always talk with your surgeon, your doctor, or your qualified healthcare team before making any changes to your diet, medication, exercise plan, or anything related to your care. Thanks for riding along.